This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I hope you're having a good Sunday and that you'll stay with us. Lots to cover in the next half hour, including Chris Christie's visit to the Miller Center, an update on the Energy Independence Summit in D.C., and how one local activist participated, alleged abuse by Cargill of its employees, and a high-flying World War II vet from Woodstock saving lives with his angel flights. We also get a roundup of Virginia politics from Jeff Shapiro. But first, after last year's violent rallies in Charlottesville and what many saw as the failure of local officials to prevent them, many citizens wanted to learn more about how local government works and how it might be structured differently in the future. The local League of Women Voters and Charlottesville Tomorrow teamed up to provide an educational discussion on the matter, divided into two events this month. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini attended the first one last Sunday.
The McIntyre Room at the Jefferson Madison Regional Library was packed. The events of last August certainly prompted a renewed interest or concern in understanding how Charlottesville is governed. So, a varied panel provided their views and expertise, including Rich Schrager, a UVA law school professor.
There's some confusion about authority, a frustration, I would think, with not quite understanding the lines of authority, first of all, and then second of all, I think some of the limitations on the authority, the capacity to do certain things.
One of the big frustrations brought up by the audience was the inability to regulate guns locally following the failed recent attempt at changing legislation in the General Assembly in Richmond.
In terms of the specific gun laws, there's not a ton you can do except operate through the political processes down there. Elections matter, as they say, and one thing you can't do is demand that the city council do something different with guns because they, in fact, can't.
The second event will look at how Charlottesville might be governed differently in the future. It'll take place on Sunday, February 25, at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center at 2 p.m.
Chris Christie, the former New Jersey governor and Republican presidential candidate, visited the Miller Center last Monday to discuss his political career and what he thinks of the first year of the Trump presidency, and Marguerite was there.
The Miller Center in Charlottesville does not often receive guests who are sympathetic to President Trump. This time, former Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie gave his take on the Trump presidency.
The race of he against Hillary Clinton was the ultimate insider versus the ultimate outsider. And I think people chose an outsider. But once you get there, you need people around you who know how to play the inside game. And I think he's been ill-served by a number of the people around him who haven't known how to pull that off.
As a former federal prosecutor, Chris Christie also discussed the possibility of special counsel Robert Mueller questioning Donald Trump.
That's a drastic step to ask a president of the United States to submit themselves to interview by the FBI. And I don't think that should be done lightly. My guess is that Bob Mueller hasn't even asked yet. He's doing this in a very methodical way. But we're not there. You know, part of the instant gratification society we live in now is everybody wants the answer now, right? What's the end of the book? We don't know. And I do think that process matters. I do think that we not only need to get to the right place, but we got to get to the right place in the right way. So we got to wait till the end of the book. We can't skip to the back.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
Also last week, advocates for alternative transportation fuels gathered in Washington, D.C. to network and meet with congressional staff and other officials. Harrisonburg's Alan Harned was there and spoke with WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
The Transportation Energy Partners 2018 Energy Independence Summit ends today after 4 days of bringing together advocates for clean transportation from across the country. Alan Harned, director of Virginia Clean Cities, said yesterday that the summit was a chance to catch up on progress and then share that progress with representatives.
We're meeting with staffers of every representative in the Virginia congressional delegation. They are all supportive and engaged.
For Virginia especially, he said, transitioning to cleaner fuels is a bipartisan desire.
All of our representatives understand that Virginia produces no oil. They understand the economic cost of spending so much of our incomes on a commodity that's totally out of state.
Harned would like to see continued collaboration between federal and other levels of government.
The ask is to have the federal government be participants, and I think we've got a real solid chance here. We certainly support the clean energy tax provisions that came through in the bipartisan budget bill last Friday.
While he would prefer that those incentives be available longer term, he said he does appreciate that they are on the books.
Local activists and union organizers have filed a charge against Cargill in Dayton for retaliating against employees because of their union activities. They say that Cargill is not living up to its own code of conduct. Christopher has this report.
2 weeks ago, a group of advocates and former employees marched to Cargill in Dayton to deliver a copy of an unfair labor practices charge against the company, calling for it to adhere to its own code of conduct that respects employees' rights to organize. In provided audio, Pastor Stephanie Sorge Wing of Trinity Presbyterian Church spoke on behalf of the Harrisonburg group Faith in Action to a Cargill representative who documented the group's concerns.
We stand in solidarity with the workers. We want our neighbors and our sisters especially to be treated fairly and with dignity.
The charge they delivered was filed with the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, earlier this year by the Maryland-based United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 400, said union organizer and interpreter Hannah Kane. The charge states that within the prior 6 months, Cargill had retaliated against 4 union supporters by terminating employment, denying overtime opportunities, assigning less favorable jobs, and denying or reducing work opportunities and hours, quote, solely because of their union activities. One of them, now a former employee, is 54-year-old Ernestina Castillo. At her kitchen table, the smell of freshly fried plantains and the chirps of her pet birds warming the room, she said through an interpreter that she was fired at the end of October after she was injured on a new line that she had been transferred to, and after she had begun wearing a union shirt and had signed a union card. She had worked for the company for more than 13 years.
Everyone else who has gotten injured on that line was given a transfer to a different line, or they were at least given additional training about how to work that line. And for me, they wouldn't give me either a transfer or training. When I couldn't put up with the pain anymore, I went to the infirmary to ask for the nurse to give me pain medication. And that was when my supervisor came to the infirmary and told me that there was no more work for me. I want to work, but they kicked me out.
The injury was their excuse to fire you because you wore the union shirt?
Yes,
well. Yep, that's it.
Cargill's director of communications is Mike Martin, based in Kansas. He wrote in an email that no one was available for interview for this report. He said that the company prefers, quote, to work directly with our team members to address issues and resolve concerns, and referred to the company's statement on human rights, which states, we respect freedom of association and the right to collectively bargain, enabling employees to join a union and voluntarily negotiate. He also wrote that in accordance with its rights and obligations, quote, at various times, Cargill brings in both internal and external resources that have experience with unions to share with our employees facts about union organizing and unions. He declined to elaborate on what is important for employees to consider when deciding about unions and organizing, and he declined to comment on Cargill's relationship with one of the company's external resources, Culture Consulting, LLC, a South Carolina-based employee and labor relations consultancy. Culture did not respond to an emailed request for comment, but its website describes its labor relations services in part as, quote, exposing the truth about union organizer tactics. According to a 2016 report filed by Cargill with the NLRB, Cargill hired Culture to, quote, assist Cargill in communicating facts and legally accurate information to employees when we knew that a union was attempting to have our employees sign authorization cards. This is troubling to Michael Snell-Fikema, a coordinator for the Community Solidarity with Poultry Workers group in Harrisonburg.
If you want to understand how these labor consultancies work, they toe the fine line. They find a way for the company to do union busting without getting nailed for it. And Cargill knows this.
He points to a 2015 NLRB administrative law judge's decision from California that names Culture and the same agent who has come to Dayton. It details interrogation and other threats in response to workers' attempts to organize. He said that the reports showing Culture's role at Cargill reflect only the tip of the iceberg, because while firms like Culture do have to disclose activities that bring them into direct contact with employees, they do not have to report their training of supervisors. And it's often the supervisors, he said, who engage in harassment activity and, quote, psychological warfare, such as trying to trick employees into doing things they could be fired for. He's heard reports of such violations of employee rights, he said, but they're difficult to prove.
I hope Cargill will accept the rights of the workers to organize, that that's a way to move from a model of the disposable workforce, which is the one they have now, to a model of a sustainable workforce, which is the only model that has a future, the only model that's good for the company, the workers, and the community.
He also wants Ernestina Castillo to be reinstated. She said she was happy back on her earlier line and needs to work.
I've been spending all my savings, everything that I managed to save over the years. And this month, my sister paid my rent.
At the ripe young age of 94, World War II pilot John Billings is still flying, and with a co-pilot friend, transporting medical patients to treatments. Christopher was busy this week. He produced this profile, too.
Spot a sun over there. Yep. Spot right there.
That's John Billings and Nevin Showman from a video of their last Angel Flight mission in 2017, flying back into Luray.
Dancing around the maypole.
I love it.
I talked with them in Woodstock, in the addition to his century-old home, where Billings spends a lot of time when he's not flying. You take the stairs to the second story, to an unassuming door.
This is my closet.
And then through a catwalk hallway and into a high-ceilinged, expansive room above his woodworking and metal lathe shop.
Wow, what a place.
There's a cozy stove burning in the corner, an entertainment center, busy office desks for him and his wife Barbara, bookshelves. We sit down, Billings, his co-pilot and friend Nevin Showman, a couple cats, and Billings offers a friendly warning.
When I get started talking about flying, I forget what time it is. I have a philosophy. Every minute that your feet are off the ground, don't count. So do as much as I can.
Billings was a military and commercial pilot, but now volunteers his skills and his own plane to transport medical patients. He first rode in an airplane more than 90 years ago.
My father took me on a ride around an airport. He went out to the local field, and I mean a field. It was a half mile on the side, field, grass, some places no grass, but no runways or anything like that. And that was called an airport. And there was a sign out front that said, "Air rides here." I can still plainly see all of what was going on.
In World War II, Billings flew 14 mass bombing missions, plus 39 covert missions. He said a lot of other pilots didn't survive nearly that many.
Statistically, I shouldn't be here. I'm glad I am.
On one trip, called Operation Greenup, Billings dropped a three-man spy team into Nazi territory in the Austrian Alps. It's a story that's been recounted in the Washington Post, and Billings himself tells about that flight in an online video.
I went on to what was called war emergency power that we could use for 5 minutes under an emergency condition. Well, I decided this was an emergency condition. So I put it up there. That wasn't enough, and we're still going down.
After the war, Billings was a commercial pilot until the 1980s. Then in 2005, he took on a new flying passion in his own Cessna Cutlass. Angel Flight Mid-Atlantic is a nonprofit that matches volunteer pilots willing to donate their time and aircraft to patients in need of transport to medical care. Billings has now made well over 400 Angel flights. For the last 8 years, most frequently with Nevin Showman, an Edinburgh TV and electronics repairman only three-fifths his age, who also loves to fly. They said the Angel flight requires pilots over age 75 to have a co-pilot.
But, for the record...
And Showman keeps their records.
He does not need me in the airplane, legally or otherwise. He is fully legal and capable of better than any other pilot I've ever flown with.
One of their Angel flight passengers was Richard Norris. In 2012, he received an extensive face transplant. And leading up to and throughout his surgeries, he said Billings and Showman flew him from Southern Virginia to Baltimore quite a few times.
We flew through some bad storms. We flew through strong headwinds. And with John's experience, you know, his days in World War II, and then Ned's experience as well, you felt safe.
And they do it because they love to, he said, paying forward their own good fortune, expecting only a thank you in return.
And they just feel truly blessed that there are people out there that understand the needs of others and are willing to help out and all I expect to return is a thank you.
Billings can't quite say what it is about flying an airplane that draws him so intensely.
It is a living, inanimate device. And if I'm here and it's over there, then it's nothing. But if I'm in it, I become it. We become one.
It's almost like romantic touch, he said.
The wax is going every which way. That's the closest I can... I'm still searching for my best flight. It's just over the hill. That probably is going to be the finest one I'm going to have, right?
Right.
He has already scheduled a flight for his 100th birthday, and he remembers a commercial co-pilot he flew with.
He died after his 105th, and his last words were, "I guess this is the end of my flying days." So that's a goal to overcome, right?
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Finally, let's check in again with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, for some analysis of the week in Virginia politics. Here talking with WCVE's Craig Carper.
Jeff, this week we passed the halfway crossover point where the House must complete all work on its own legislation and the Senate must do the same and send the opposite chamber their bills. What's been passed and what has gone away?
Gun restrictions have been blocked on both sides, but of course that issue was revisited this week in floor speeches in the House and Senate pegged to that terrible mass shooting in South Florida. Confederate monuments appear to be safe, as I think we discussed last weekend. For now, all of that legislation, largely pushed by Democrats, giving local governments the power to decide whether these statues should be raised or remain, pretty much finished for the year. Protections for LGBTQ Virginians, gone. But this is an important point in the calendar because of what comes immediately after crossover, that procedural halfway point. The House and Senate budget committees will be rolling out their versions of the state budget. That's not only adjustments to the existing state budget, which lapses on June 30th, but the budget as proposed by former Governor McAuliffe for the 2 years beginning July 1st. These budgets could contain some very significant clues about Medicaid expansion, which remains the big issue in this session. And we have been seeing some interesting developments of late on that.
That's right. We've long heard rumors of Republicans who might support Medicaid expansion under the right circumstances this week. A high-profile Republican delegate, Terry Kilgore, coming out in favor of a limited form of expansion.
Now, Kilgore's endorsement, it's significant, I would argue, largely because of where Kilgore is from. He's a Southwest Virginian. His district is among a dozen or so Republican-held districts that stand to benefit greatly if Republicans go along with some form of Medicaid expansion. When I say benefit greatly, in that there are large numbers of uninsured Virginians in these districts. The larger point here is that the Kilgore endorsement, and again, he favors some type of Kentucky-like works for benefit requirement, which, not unlike the position the Speaker, Republican Kirk Cox, had taken earlier in the session, this is important political cover. Republicans don't want to fight this battle any longer because having had their heads handed to them, not just because of Donald Trump, but because of the health care fight, they want to move on. They're worried about protecting what remains of their majority if that is possible. There was another development on the Senate side that speaks to this unfolding drama. That is that the Senate voted unanimously to support Medicaid expansion for Virginians, 20,000 Virginians with mental and chronic illnesses. If they can agree on that, all of them, there's a pretty good chance most of them can agree on how to pay for it, which they didn't address in that vote earlier this week, and whether it could be expanded. Of course, possibly 400,000 uninsured Virginians could be brought under the Medicaid umbrella. Political cover is important, too, for the Democrats. Governor Northam has said he doesn't really like a work requirement, but he's flexible. He initially favored a no-strings-attached Medicaid expansion. That's very popular with the Democratic grassroots, but it doesn't look like either side's going to get everything for which they wish.
Jeff, we don't see a lot of big surprises during the 60-day session, but one happened this week as the House approved a last-minute amendment to the bill regulating Dominion Energy.
I think it was a shocker not just for the Democrats who managed to pull it off with the help of some Republicans, but for the power companies. Dominion Energy and Appalachian Power have included in this bill, which they have helped write, what is called the double dip. That would allow the companies to keep the billions in excess earnings, plow them, these are dollars that otherwise might have been refunded to customers, plow them into improvements to the grid, then charge customers for it. And it could arguably be a triple dip if one considers that there's then depreciation, there's tax benefits for the companies as well. This means going forward that this could be a very tricky bill for the utilities and their allies, most notably the legislative leadership in the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats. And it also suggests that Governor Northam, who negotiated what was supposed to be a compromise, is now facing a revolt within the legislative wing of his party. I know his office says otherwise, but when all 49 Democrats in the House vote against the bill that your office essentially helped write, it seems to me that qualifies as a revolt.
And finally, the Senate has approved loosening some marijuana laws, but fell short of approving any kind of full-on decriminalization.
And full-on decriminalization had been the objective of the sponsor of that bill, the Senate Republican Majority Leader, Tommy Norment. He retreated on that, instead pushing through this bill that would make it easier to erase from your record a first charge for possession of small amounts of marijuana. There is the argument that this bill would stand a better chance in the House, where the Republican majority, that greatly reduced Republican majority, remains stubbornly firm on law and order issues. We saw an example of that as well when the House and the Senate, for that matter, of Republicans, struck a deal with Governor Northam on raising the felony threshold from $200 to $500. It had been one of the lowest in the country, tied with New Jersey's. But the trade-off was that the Republicans insisted, and Northam accepted, much stronger requirements for criminals to repay their victims.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
Looking forward to it.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund at the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. All of our stories are archived at WMRA.org. If you'd like to support our ability to continue producing them, go to that website, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. And here's a great way to keep up with local and statewide news each weekday with WMRA, including the latest on this year's General Assembly session. Subscribe to our daily news podcast. It's called the WMRA Daily, and you'll get a news update on your smartphone every weekday morning. Just go to WMRA.org and look for the black WMRA coffee mug with the blue sticky note that says daily. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.